I want to start by sketching what a modern stateless society might look like, what the set of institutions would be, how I think they would work, go on to discuss what its advantages would be over the institutions we're used to in which certain things are done by government, discuss what's wrong with it, discuss what problems might arise with that set of institutions, say a little bit about how we might get there, and maybe say a little bit about historical models that correspond in one way or another to what I'm describing. The set of institutions I'm imagining are ones in which there are firms selling the service of enforcing people's rights and settling their disputes, rights enforcement agencies. Each individual is the customer of one such firm, just as people are now the customers of an insurance company, say, for their auto insurance. And the obvious question is, the problem that everybody raises with such a system is what happens when there's a conflict between two people who are customers of different firms. So my sort of standard example is somebody comes into my house, steals my television set. My rights enforcement agency has prudently set up a camera in my living room which videoed the whole incident so they can figure out who it is. Nowadays, they can probably use face recognition to do it. So they inform the person who stole the television set that he ought to bring my television set back. And he says, "What television set? I've got a nice television set. A friend of mine, who I'm not going to tell you anything about, gave it to me. Never heard about Mr. Friedman." And so my agency says, "Well, we're sorry you feel like that. Four big tough men are going to show up at your front door tomorrow morning to recover Mr. Friedman's television set." And he says, "Well, that's terrible. I'm sorry to hear that there are some thugs coming to steal my television set. But my rights enforcement agency will send six big tough guys in order to make sure my television set doesn't get stolen." And then you have a war between the two rights enforcement agencies. And that's basically what Ayn Rand imagined happened and what a lot of people when they first hear about such systems imagine. But it's not a very plausible outcome because wars are expensive. And if you follow, if the two agencies follow that policy, they're going to have to pay hazard pay to their employees. They are going to lose customers who don't like having their front lawns turned into free fire zones. And it would make a whole lot more sense from the standpoint of both of them to find some peaceful way of resolving the dispute. And the obvious solution is that you find a private court, an arbitration agency, and both of them agree to accept the verdicts of that private court in any such future disputes. Each one then knows that while it may have to give up its customer in some cases where the court thinks he's guilty, on the other hand, when it goes the other way, they will win the case. And then the next question you ought to ask if you're thinking about this is, well, that's very nice. They have a contract agreeing to do this. What enforces that contract? There's no government to enforce contracts. And the answer is what enforces the contract is the fact that they are repeat players. What is sometimes referred to as the discipline of constant dealings. Each of them knows that if when his customer loses the case, they refuse to go along with it, then the next time when their customer wins, the other side won't go along with it, and then they are back fighting each other, and they're going to lose their customers to some third agency that has a less violent way of protecting the rights of its customers. So that's the basic guts of what I'm describing, and it's a system in which rights enforcement has become private rather than public. And then the next question that might occur to you is, what laws are they enforcing? What generates the laws? We don't have a legislature in this system either. And the answer is that the laws are being produced on the market by the arbitration agencies. That what does the arbitration agency want? It wants to have a set of laws it judges by and a set of procedures to judge that will provide a product that rights enforcement agencies want to buy. What do the rights enforcement agencies want? They want to buy a product, services of a arbitration agency that their customers will want, because that way they get their customers. So that means that you have a market mechanism which is generating law. It will not necessarily generate uniform law. It might be that the law between rights enforcement agency A and B is different than the law between C and D, and even different than the law between B and C. That sounds a little bit weird to us, but if you actually think about it, it's true at present that in the US under our present system, what the law is settling a particular dispute depends, among other things, what state or city it occurred under. That is itself a complicated question because not all disputes have a geographical location. So if you have an accident that happens involving a car that was bought in Indiana, is being driven in California by a citizen of Texas, who settles any disputes between you and the car company? And that's one of the things that law students have to study and figure out. But in fact, we don't actually have a uniform legal system at present, even though one tends to imagine that one does. What kind of law is it going to produce? In particular, is it going to produce libertarian law? And the answer is maybe. If you think about it as an economist, you imagine, I like to imagine that two rights enforcement agencies disagree about what the law should be. And my standard example is that the customers of one of them like the idea of capital punishment. They want to make sure that if anybody kills them, he will be executed, possibly because that means people won't kill them. The customers of the other agency don't like the idea. They think it's immoral, or they're afraid they will be convicted of a murder they did or didn't commit, and don't want to have the risk. So the two agencies are bargaining, in effect, or through the middleman of the arbitration agency over which law they will have. So the first agency says to itself, does a little market research, and it says, well, we could sell our services for an extra $1 million a year if we could guarantee our customers that in disputes with the other agency, capital punishment will apply. And the other agency does its market research and it concludes to a $2 million a year. Well, simple enough, they agree on no capital punishment and $1.5 million payment by one agency to the other, or very likely a agreement in the other direction on some other disputed point. But if you think about the economic logic of it, what they're basically looking for is the law that maximizes the value to the customers in dollars of the legal rules they have. What an economist would describe as economically efficient law. For the non-economists in the audience, the standard economic solution to the problem of how do you add up benefits and costs to other people, even though economists usually don't say so, is to do it as if you believed that a dollar is worth the same amount to everybody. So you think about it in terms of willingness to pay. This is an idea that goes back to Alfred Marshall, who more or less put together modern economics, and standard textbooks tend to obscure it in various ways. Not true of my textbooks, but that's the basic logic of it. So the next question you ought to ask is, will it be libertarian? And that's why I say maybe. On the one hand, one of the reasons we are libertarians is that we believe that liberty is economically efficient. That is, we believe that on the whole, the world will be better in most ways if people's rights are respected, and that it is very rarely the case that the value to me of violating your rights is greater than the cost to you of having your rights violated. You would therefore expect economically efficient law to tend to be efficient, to be libertarian law. But there could be exceptions. In particular, the market gives people not what they should want, but what they do want. And you could imagine a society, for example, where most people think that heroin addiction is a terrible thing, probably have a somewhat mistaken view of what it's actually like, and therefore believe nobody should be allowed to use heroin. And if that belief is widely enough held, it will be in the interest of the arbitration agencies to include in their legal rules against heroin, and of the rights enforcement agencies to enforce it. In effect, there will be a legal system in which the individual citizen has a right to prevent other people from using heroin. And you can think of other examples of that sort. On the other hand, under the same circumstances, you can be pretty sure that a government-run legal system will also make heroin illegal, because it doesn't take anything close to unanimity to make it politically profitable to make such a restriction. So I think the answer is that we could expect it to be considerably more libertarian than what would come out of a political system other than a dictatorship run by a libertarian, which is not a likely option. There is not a guarantee that it will be entirely libertarian. And this, I think, represents maybe the most important difference between my model of anarcho-capitalism and Murray Rothbard's. If I correctly understand him, and somebody who has read more of his work is welcome to correct me, he imagines that the legal system of an anarcho-capitalist society will in effect be written by libertarian legal philosophers, and that the legal philosopher will figure out what the law ought to be, and then all of the private courts will enforce it. And I see two problems with this program. The first is that in my experience, libertarians don't in fact agree with each other about what the law should be. Two striking examples. One of them is the question of intellectual property. As best I can tell, Ayn Rand, who was in fact a libertarian, even if she didn't like to call herself that, thought that intellectual property was the most justified version of property, whereas quite a lot of other libertarians believe that intellectual property law is obviously a violation of rights. That would be one example. Abortion would be the other obvious example. And I'm sure with a little effort, one could think about a dozen more. So that's the first problem. The second problem is, even if there was a correct answer, why would the courts enforce it? It's not as if a private court is run by a philosopher who wants to make sure he does what's just. A private court is a private firm trying to maximize its profits. And there is no particular reason to expect it to be persuaded by philosophical arguments, even if there are good philosophical arguments to persuade it. Whereas in my mechanism, I am relying not on moral philosophy, but on economics. And the basic argument is that it will be in the private profit-making interest of the arbitration agencies to choose the laws that it is in the private profit-making interest of the rights enforcement agencies to buy, and that those will be the laws that, on the whole, maximize the welfare of the customers. Now, any economists in the room can probably figure out that this is an oversimplification in a number of ways, but I think it's basically fundamentally correct analysis. Next question is going to be, what are the advantages of this system over the government system? Because after all, a believer in democracy will say, well, it's very nice that you're trying to make laws that people like, but so does the democratic system, that after all, the politicians have to get elected. They want to get elected, so how do you get elected? You pass the laws that people like and do other things. I'm taking laws really as shorthand for a whole bunch of stuff, for how do you enforce the laws, when are policemen allowed to shoot people, how do you punish people, whatever the whole structure of law and law enforcement. And laws are a useful shorthand for that. And the fundamental difference, let me start with the argument that I like to make to classical liberals, to people who are what I would describe as moderate libertarians. They agree that if the government is in charge of making cars, cars will be expensive and badly run. They agree that if the government is in charge of growing and distributing food, there will be famines. We have evidence of this, experimental evidence, unfortunately. Creating a legal system is not a trivial problem. It is not clear that designing a legal system is any easier a problem than designing a car. That libertarians and other people who haven't thought much about the law tend to speak as if it was trivial. You just make it illegal to violate people's rights. But if you really think about it, you discover that what that means is not at all clear. To take the very simplest example, if somebody robs you and is caught, and he has to give the money back. If all the law requires is that he gives back the money that he took from you, then robbery will be a profitable profession because sometimes you are caught and give the money back and sometimes you aren't caught. Heads I win, tails I break even. Well, that suggests that I should have some additional punishment, whether paying more money or going to jail or whatever. How do you decide what it is? And Rothbard's answer was it should be twice the amount taken. And as far as I can tell, neither he nor anyone else has ever given a reason for that. That if you're in a society where most thieves get away with theft, which would depend on the particular circumstances, giving back twice, it's still profitable. I could give an answer, but not in this talk, that one of my specialties for the last few decades has been economic analysis of law. And I can describe how, in principle, if you knew enough, you would work out what the schedule of punishments was that maximized economic efficiency. That for the utilitarians in the room, that would be maximizing total utility if everybody had the same marginal utility of income. Technical terms for anyone who's interested in those ideas. But in fact, on philosophical grounds, I don't think you can answer the question. And there are a lot of other complications that, you know, again, from the outside it seems easy, but if you actually go to a law school and spend 3 years trying to understand this stuff, you realize that the whole structure of the law involves a whole bunch of uncertain questions about under what circumstances is a contract enforceable. If the contract's enforceable, does that mean that that if I can't deliver the goods, I've got to deliver the goods at any cost, or that I pay you damages for not delivering the goods, and how are the damage calculated, and so forth and so on. And that could be another talk. But basically, it turns out that designing a legal system is a non-trivial problem. Well, if governments aren't very good at building cars or growing food, they probably aren't very good at designing legal systems either. So just as the solution to those problems is to have it done on the market, so the solution, I think, to designing a legal system is to have that done on the market as well. Next, consider the mechanism for controlling a democratic government versus the mechanism for controlling an anarcho-capitalist system. In theory, if the politicians do bad things, we vote them out. But for some reason, politicians never announce they're doing bad things. I am pretty sure that there has never been a bill introduced to Congress with the title, A Bill to Make Farmers Richer and City Folks Poorer. We, in fact, have such a bill, I think, every year. I'm not sure. It's called the Farm Bill. And usually part of what it does is to try to push up the price of agricultural products. But that's not how it's labeled. So no politician runs as the bad guy. So that means that in order to do an intelligent job of voting in order to use democracy to control governments, you have to have a lot of information. You have to actually know what the politician has been doing, what he should be doing, which parts of his statement are false. Not a trivial problem. Why should you acquire that information? Well, in the US, if in a presidential election, changing one vote for a candidate has something around one chance in 2 million of changing the outcome of the election. So the payoff to you of being an informed voter is very, very close to zero. So that means that you do not have an incentive to get the information you would need to have in order for a democracy to work. Now, this wouldn't be true if we were talking about a democracy in a small society where the government did only a few things, because then you might well have the information from firsthand observation. You could see, you know, you saw that cop taking a bribe. But when you're talking about a society of hundreds of millions of people and the government is spending literally trillions of dollars a year, it isn't really practical to cheaply find out. Everybody thinks they know. But oddly enough, about half of them think one candidate is the good guy and half of them the other. Now compare that to the market situation, whether for laws or cars or anything else. If I try to figure out which of two cars is best for me, I have 100% chance that that will determine which car I get, instead of a one chance in 2 million of determining which president I get. So in that sense, the market provides a much better incentive for informed choice. Not perfect, information is expensive, but a much better incentive. Furthermore, the information is cheaper in the market case because you can compare alternatives. Nobody will ever know how the Biden administration of these 4 years compares to the Trump administration that could have happened for these 4 years. Lots of people think they know, of course. Some of them are sure that one of them would be better, and some of them are sure the other did. But we don't have it. We don't have the data. We only run the experiment once with one candidate. On the other hand, you can compare different cars. Now, the situation for rights enforcement agencies is not as good because we don't have as many. We aren't likely to have as many rights enforcement agencies as cars in a given area. And you can't test drive very well. But if you know other people, or if there are rating agencies of various sorts, you can check the prices they charge. You can say, well, what can we know about the crime rate among the people who they are protecting? How much did, when your friend got into a law case, did it take 6 months or three days to settle it? How expensive was the lawyer? There are a whole bunch of information you're going to get, which, while very far from perfect, allows you to make a reasonably informed choice among different rights enforcement agencies, just as today you make a reasonably informed choice among different cars, different grocery stores, and so forth. So that means that we would expect this institution to have more nearly well-designed laws, both because they're being designed on the market and because the individual actors have an incentive to be well-informed, and because the individual actors actually have a way of being well-informed. So that's, from my standpoint, the basic advantage, that you have a mechanism which pushes laws towards being the kind of laws we want and pushes them to being well-designed laws. So the next question is, what's wrong with it? Because there are things wrong with it. There aren't any perfect solutions, all right? My favorite online author is a guy called Scott Alexander, who used to run a blog called Slate Star Codex, which I spent a lot of time on. He's a young psychiatrist with an enormous amount of intellectual energy and a whole lot of a very broad range of interests. And he would write highly enlightening essays on anything he felt like it. Among other things, he reviewed two of my books. The review of Machinery of Freedom was what I would describe as a friendly but critical review, which is just fine, much more useful than a review that just agrees with me. But the last line of it was what I liked, because the last line of it was, I hope this set of institutions is tried somewhere far from me. And he's right, right? We don't know enough to predict with confidence how institutions will work. So I can offer what I think are the best arguments for why I think it would work well, but without doing the experiment, you know, I could be wrong. Better to have someone else do the experiment, and if it works, we can be the second mover. So what are the ways in which it could go wrong? To begin with, there are predictable ways in which the law will be short of perfectly efficient. And the reason is that in deciding what laws we want, between agencies A and B, we are only concerned with the interest of customers of agency A and B. But the law between customers of agency A and B might affect customers of agency C. And my standard example of this is intellectual property. From an economist's standpoint, the question of whether you should have intellectual property laws depends on whether the costs of having them is larger or smaller than the benefits. So let's think about a copyright law as a simple example. The benefit of a law saying that you need my permission to copy my books is benefit to me of getting royalties. That's canceled by the cost to you of paying the royalties. The benefit to the cost to both of us of transactions, of the fact that if you want to make a copy of my book, you'll have to negotiate with me to do it. That involves time and cost for both of us. Furthermore, the fact that you will buy and I will sell what an economist would call a suboptimal number of books, because suppose that the price of the book with the copyright fee is $10. The cost of producing the book is $8. And the value to you of the book is $9. All right, you won't buy the book. If you got the book for $8, that would be a dollar gain to you. If you bought the book for $9, that would be a dollar gain to me. Both of us are losing the opportunity to get that gain, because I have no way of knowing that you're somebody who wouldn't pay $10 for the book, and therefore I'm going to charge you the same price as everybody else. That's what an economist refers to as deadweight loss, the fact that I'm charging a price for a book which is above the cost of producing one extra book. Doesn't cost me anything. The copyright part of it doesn't cost me anything. I like when people say they like my books, I say I'm always happy to do good at zero marginal cost. And it is zero marginal cost when one more person reads my book or copies my book or whatever. So that's one inefficiency because, sorry, I haven't gotten to the inefficiency yet. The benefit is that I'll produce more books because I have an incentive to produce books and I'm paid for it. That benefit, however, is not only a benefit to you, it's not only a benefit to fellow members of your rights enforcement agency, it's especially a benefit to customers of rights enforcement agency C, which has not agreed to enforce my copyright, because they get the book without having to pay me copyright, they make their own copies. That benefit is being ignored. So even if the total benefit from having copyright law were larger than the total cost, because of the benefit of greater incentives to write books, it might well not be profitable for the agencies to agree on copyright law, and you would then get a suboptimal, in the economist sense, level of intellectual property enforcement. So that's one example. Now, the other obvious example is pollution. If you think about air pollution that is not local, air pollution that where you put something in the air and it affects the whole continent, say, well, in that case, again, the two rights enforcement agencies would agree to a law against such pollution if the costs on their customers were larger than the benefits of being able to do whatever creates the pollution. But they're not going to take account of the costs on everybody else. So if you really believe that global warming is a terrible problem due to carbon dioxide, I've got news for you. It'll still be a terrible problem under an anarcho-capitalist system. Because under that system, there is no mechanism to reflect back the costs on everybody in the world. Now, of course, there isn't a good mechanism to do that now anyway. And as it happens, I'm somewhat skeptical about the claim that climate change will do a lot of damage. That could be another talk, but my view is that climate change is indeed real. It is likely that CO2 is the main cause of it. It will have both positive and negative effects. Both are very uncertain, and we do not know whether the net effect is positive or negative. That would be another talk. People can read other stuff I've written for that subject. But my only point is that if it were a serious problem, it's not going to get solved by these institutions. So they are by no means perfect. So those are ways in which the anarcho-capitalist system will do less well than a state run by an all-wise benevolent despot. All right, that I think of the economic criterion of, is this an efficient outcome, as being the best outcome you could imagine getting, and that's the outcome you would get if the world was run by an all-powerful, benevolent, all-knowing despot, what I sometimes call a bureaucrat god. And you're not going to get that with any set of institutions. Next question is, are there ways worse than that? Because after all, there's no reason to get that with the democratic system as well. The democratic system might give you too little intellectual property law, it might give you too much. It might, in fact, in our case does, I think, give you very costly things justified as controlling global warming, which make us worse off. As you may know, the U.S. currently destroys roughly 10% of the world crop of the largest source of food in the world, which is maize. It does it by turning it into alcohol. The argument for doing that when they passed these laws was that it would reduce CO2. People eventually did the calculations and concluded that it did not reduce CO2, that as much CO2 was produced in the process of growing and converting the maize as would be produced by burning gasoline instead. And even Al Gore has conceded that. We still have the law. Why do we still have the law? Because farmers vote. And the effect of the biofuels program is to push up the price of maize, and farmers like selling their goods for high price, just like anybody else would. So It's not like you can expect to have the optimum from the government either. But I think it is worth seeing what are the ways in which the institutions I'm arguing for will produce less than the ideal outcome. There are, however, more serious problems, because there are at least two ways in which the system might break down seriously. One of them is the problem of national defense, because defense against nations is what economists call a public good, meaning it is a good where the people who produce it can't control who gets it, and therefore can't charge for it. That's the basically the guts of the idea of a public good. So that means that it is hard to pay for it. And there are a number of ways in which public goods are privately produced. At this very instant, I would like to believe that I am privately producing a public good, because I would like to believe that enlightening all of you about anarcho-capitalism will result in a better world, and I can't capture the benefit of that better world for myself. And there are lots of other ways. One of my standard examples, which we in fact spend a lot of money on, is tipping. That when you tip a waiter in a restaurant you won't come back to, or a cab driver you will never see again, you are producing a public good. You are creating an incentive for the waiter and the cab driver to do a good job, but you can't control, you aren't the one who will get the benefit. Different case if it's a restaurant you go to every day, of course, but in the other case. Nonetheless, people spend billions of dollars a year doing it. So there are a variety of mechanisms of social pressure, altruism, and so forth, which can raise money. And I spent a chapter in the first edition of Machinery of Freedom and another chapter in the third edition on what I think is the really hard problem of national defense. I could imagine societies for which it was unsolvable. I am not at all sure that I would recommend anarcho-capitalism to Estonia, for example, because they happen to have a very large neighbor who's very aggressive. The US, however, has a neighbor to the south who is poor and unaggressive, and a neighbor to the north that is small and unaggressive, and I don't think it would take a very large fraction of what we now spend on national defense to defend ourselves against both of them. And I sketch in the third edition, the current edition of Machinery, ways in which you might get a substantial amount of national defense cheaply by taking advantage of the fact that people like to play soldier. So in about a month, I'm going to be at the Pensac War, which is an event sort of like this, but about 10,000 people, run by the Society for Creative Anachronism. And you will have armies of about 1,000 people aside. Now, it's true they're using swords and shields rather than guns and mortars and things, fighting for the fun of it. There is a much larger number of people who use paintball to fight for the fun of it. And of course, there are a lot of people who play games of various sorts. So one can certainly imagine a society in which one of the popular sports was training for military stuff, doing fake battles with referees who say who would have won, and so forth. And I actually cite a Kipling story, which is on that idea in the chapter. So that could be a way in which you get a whole lot of trained people cheaply, and then use whatever money you raise voluntarily by donations, essentially, to have a small core of professionals who, in peacetime, simply provide services to the hobbyists. They're the referees and such, and teach them and stuff, and then in wartime will coordinate. So it's not an impossible picture, but neither is it a guarantee that most of my arguments are sort of standard economic arguments for why things will work, and this is really an argument for why it might. So that's one threat, is the possibility that you might be conquered by an adjacent state. The other threat is that the system might turn out to be internally unstable. So suppose you end up with only two or three rights enforcement agencies. It might occur to them that robbery is really more profitable than selling a service in a competitive market. So they could make an agreement that either they could merge and reinvent government, or they could agree that each of them will not accept customers switched from the other one. So each of them now has a monopoly over their present customers and raises their price accordingly. So there's nothing in the logic of the situation that guarantees that couldn't happen. And the fundamental question, I think, is economies of scale. If it turns out that very large rights enforcement agencies can do a much better job cheaper than small ones, you end up with a small number of rights enforcement agencies and the system very likely collapses. I don't think that's very likely, but it's not impossible that different industries turn out to have different levels of economies of scale. If you end up with 100 rights enforcement agencies, if two of them try to make such a deal, the customers will leave them and hire a third. So those are, I think, the two things you have to worry about in terms of the system not working imperfectly, but not working at all. One of them is that it might be taken over by an adjacent state, and the other is that it might turn into a state due to what I would think of as cartelization, the firms agreeing to coordinate. All right, let me go on to discuss the question of how, in your lifetime, things along these lines might happen. This is not a prediction. These are conjectures. And there are basically, I think, about four different patterns going on which are possible. The first one is the Fabian approach. This is the approach that that brought socialism to England. All right, the Fabian approach, named after a Roman general who basically lost a lot of battles but avoided losing any critical battles until he wore his opponent out, Fabius Maximus, against Hannibal. The Fabian approach is to make things a little bit more the way you want them, and then a little bit more the way you want them, and then a little bit more than the way you want them. And in our society, there are basically two ways you can do that. One of them is political. You can, for example, support a voucher system on the grounds that a educational system, which is private schools subsidized by the state, is closer to what we want than an educational system that schools run by the state, is less likely to persuade people that the state is good. You can try to lobby for holding down government spending, for reducing regulation, all the sort of standard things that classical liberals and libertarians and Republicans, when they remember what their ideology is supposed to say, try to do, not very successfully. But you can try to make political changes which will move things a little bit in the right direction. The other thing you can try to do is to create institutions that substitute for the government, because people are less likely to support the government doing something if it doesn't have to, if they can see that it doesn't have to. And my standard example of that is UPS, that 40 years ago, if you proposed abolishing the post office, the obvious response is, but who will deliver the mail? Well, we have answers to that. FedEx and UPS will deliver the mail. The only reason they don't deliver the mail now is there's a law against it, private express statutes, which are what put an anarchist mail system out of business. Lysander Spooner's American Letter Company in the century, two centuries ago, roughly. But you could do the same thing in other ways, that the more you have private institutions substituting for government functions, the less the political pressure for the government to keep doing those things. So I think those are, as I see it at least, the two ways of sort of nudging our society in the right direction. There are then a number of sort of more radical approaches. One of them is largely due to my elder son. And that was, his idea was seasteading. And his idea was that if you could develop a technology for floating housing, for big rafts that people would live on, you could then have a competitive market for political institutions. All right, we get a bunch of seasteads, and we all like the following system, and we put them all together adjacent to each other, and we now have a town, and the town has legal rules. And if some of the people decide they don't like it, they call a tugboat, they pull their seastead away, they find somebody who can who agrees with them, and they create a new one. So his basic argument, which I think was a very good argument, is that it isn't enough to say what political changes do we want. You need a way of making it in people's interest to have those changes happen, and you don't have that in our present system. So that's one approach. My guess is it won't work, but if it did work, it would be very, really lovely. I should say there are really implicitly two different models. One of them is your seastead is inside the territorial waters of a country, and you get the country to allow you to do what you want, and the reason you get them to do that is because you can go into somebody else's territorial waters if they offer you a better deal, and maybe you pay them off. The alternative is you put it on the high seas, and now you don't have that problem, you only have the problem of what do you do when the Chinese Navy shows up and says you're now part of China. So there are problems there. The second possibility, which is happening, which is not quite anarcho-capitalism but is in that direction, is the development of private cities. And one of the models is Hong Kong as it was. Another model is the special economic zones in China. As you may know, at the point when China was in the process of what turned out to be a shift towards a basically capitalist system, though not nearly as capitalist as I would like, one of the things that happened was that after Mao died, the high-up Chinese were finally able to go abroad. And they discovered that their society, which they truly believed had the world's best economic system, was dirt poor. So they concluded we're doing something wrong. We don't know what we're doing wrong. Let's experiment and find out. And one idea they had was, let's set up little zones, places we don't really care about, where we have capitalist rules instead of communist rules, and watch. And then we can get some clever ideas and introduce those ideas into our socialist system, and we can be as rich as Japan. It's not a stupid idea. Xiamen, if I remember correctly, was basically a fishing village. I think it's now about 6 million people. So that what happened was the special economic zones prospered and the exception ate the rule. So all of China switched to that system. And it's, you know, it's certainly not a perfectly capitalist system, but compared to what it had. And I should say the result of that was an increase in per capita income of considerably over an order of magnitude, maybe not quite two orders of magnitude in the years since Mao died. So there are a lot of people now, including the same elder son in his current project, who are involved with trying to make deals with poor countries that will agree that there is some area of their territory where they will maintain sovereignty, and probably they'll maintain criminal law, but civil law will be up to the entrepreneurs. So you have a project to create a sort of mini state inside a state. The incentive for the country that's hosting it is because we'd like to be rich and not poor. And the idea is that you then introduce a good set of legal institutions and prosper, you hope. And there's an obvious problem with that, namely that the temptation for the host country is to say, great, once you've invested lots of stuff, we're going to take it over. So you're going to have to worry about how you control that. And I have not been involved in this project other than as an observer. But it could give you a world where, especially if you're reasonably mobile, and the internet makes it a lot easier to be mobile, because you can work online, you can have friendships online, then you will be in a world where, in effect, you've got lots of little mini states competing for your custom. And that gets you something rather like what I've described, although it's a different mechanism. The third and most radical version is what's sometimes referred to as crypto-anarchy. That it turns out that the technologies of public key encryption make it possible to have interactions online that no third party can observe, and that includes cash interactions. There are, you can find on my webpage an old article entitled A World of Strong Privacy, which discusses how you could have what's in effect an anarcho-capitalist online world at the same time when states still control real space. And so that's a different way, and probably the most likely way, because you already have a good deal of that online. That would be another talk again. Let me say a little bit about the forms of this that already exist as things we take for granted. In fact, quite a lot of legal disputes are presently handled by arbitration. And that's partly because many countries agree that arbitrated decisions will be enforceable in the courts. But in fact, the widespread use of arbitration predates those rules. So that you have basically reputational mechanisms to enforce it, because if I agree to arbitration and then I renege on that agreement, other people in the industry will know they can't trust me, and that makes it harder to do business. So you have that. I like to argue that the present auto insurance market is evidence for my argument about why anarcho-capitalism would not be violent. Because in the anarcho-capitalism system, when there's a dispute between customers of two different agencies, they have a choice between an expensive way of trying to get their way, which is fighting, and agreeing on a cheap way of settling by a previous agreement. If you have an auto accident, and the other person in the accident is a customer of a different insurance company, each insurance company would like to believe that the other company is liable for the costs of the accident. They could litigate. That's the equivalent of fighting a war. That's expensive. They don't. In fact, as I understand it, I'm not an expert on this, the car insurance companies have a set of rules of thumb that they all agree to. And they don't always get the right answer, but they're really cheap. And they use those to decide which company will be liable. So that would be an example of a sort of miniature version, an analog, as it were, of my system existing at present. Let me say a little bit about the historical examples. Because when I originally thought up this idea, which was about 50 years ago, when my first book was published, I thought of it as something I was inventing as a conjectural set of institutions. My most recent book is called Legal Systems Very Different from Ours, and it looks at a whole lot of historical legal systems, including a few that still exist. And I concluded that in my first book, I was reinventing the wheel. That in fact, there have been a variety of what we would think of as relatively primitive societies, which had what were essentially much simplified versions of what I'm describing. And that book covers a number of them. The one that's probably most familiar to libertarians is Saga Period Iceland, which was a society where if you killed somebody, his relatives sued you. And if they won the case and you refused to pay off, there was no government mechanism to enforce it, but it was now legal to kill them. And there were various reasons why in practice it seems to have worked moderately well, not perfectly. No system works perfectly. So I have a chapter in the legal systems book on feud law, which is what was the basic logic of these systems, which is if you wrong me, I threaten to harm you unless you compensate me. And then the ways in which different societies have solved the problems, keeping it from being used for extortion, protecting people who don't have very much power, and things of that sort. But that's another chapter in another book. But in any case, Saga Period Iceland is a semi-stateless society because they did have a law code. They had a legislature and a law code, but no government mechanism to enforce it. Northern Somalia, before recent developments, before the creation of the country of Somalia, was a fully stateless society because there was no government law code and there were mechanisms for settling disputes. The Comanche are my favorite example of why a stateless society is not necessarily unable to engage in national defense. Because the problem the Comanche posed for quite a long time was how to defend other people from them. The Comanche raided, they prevented expansion across Texas for about a generation. They raided both into Mexico and into the US. They were eventually destroyed by a society with like 100 times their population and much more advanced technology. And that was a society whose institutions made fighting profitable. And I could go into that. I do go into that in the book. But not a very attractive society, I should say. But a nice example of the fact that according to what the society is like and the institutions are like, sometimes military can be produced very cheaply indeed, at a profit indeed. And I discuss also the Romani, because the Romani are a case of a society that still exists, and which in fact, though it's I think in the US at least declining, that is becoming less different, but that some of the Romani societies are basically feud societies. In which private action controlled in various ways is how you enforce rights among each other. Let me finish, because I think I'm roughly running out of time. I haven't followed it exactly. I am. That the places where you can get more information on this stuff are two books, The Machinery of Freedom and Legal Systems Very Different from Ours. I have a webpage. The webpage is daviddfriedman.com. The webpage has a PDF of the full text of the current edition of Machinery. It's got a link to a very late draft of the full edition of Legal Systems. And it has the text of most of the articles that I have written and a number of my books. So if you just find that, that should do it. daviddfriedman.com. In addition, I believe I am doing an AMA and Ask Me Anything on anarcho-capitalism tomorrow afternoon, I think at 2 o'clock, I don't remember where, probably Firesteel, which is where I mostly do things, and if people have questions, they are welcome to come there. I assume we probably have a few minutes. I assume I'm supposed to quit by about 5:55 so that there's time for whoever is next to get ready, but we've got, I think, about 4 minutes if people have questions. Yes, you had a question.
On. Is it on?
There it is.
Okay, my question is, Dr. Friedman, what would you say the founding fathers could have done? If you'd gone back in a time machine and said, listen, guys, I mean, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit, but just tell me what you think you would have told them.
The answer is that I don't know. Because I would have to know more than I do about the constraints they faced. It's not as if the founding fathers are dictators who can do whatever they want. Some people have argued that the system before the Constitution, the Articles of the Confederation, was better and would have worked better. It might be true. I just don't know. Yes, another question.
I would like you to expound in as much detail as you find appropriate with the time you have left. What you mentioned earlier, you kind of teased it about the sort of system of weights and measures, the balancing for how to exactly align incentives so that the thief does not decide, okay, this seems like a profitable venture.
Yes. The short answer is that another book of mine called Law's Order, which is both a textbook and a book intended for the intelligent layman on economic analysis of law, spends a good deal of time working that through. And what's basically going on is that you would like ideally to deter, from an economist standpoint, any crime where the cost to the victim is larger than the benefit to the criminal. And that's an odd way of putting it because libertarians are used to thinking in moral terms. But then you have to decide what's a crime. However, deterring crimes is costly. You've got to have police, you have punishments, and locking somebody up is costly to the guy who's being locked up and to the people who are paying for the prison, and so forth. So therefore, you have to balance the benefit of deterring crimes that do more damage than the benefit to the criminal against the costs of actually enforcing it. And you figure out what level of punishment and what probability of punishment minimizes total costs. That would be a very short version, but I do go through it, and I think I've got some links to some articles where I go through that question as well.
Under our current legal system, it seems like the amount of money you can pay can have an influence on the outcome of a case. Are you at all concerned about that private rights enforcement agencies would exacerbate that problem?
But notice that not only is getting what I want more valuable in dollars if I'm richer, it's also true that the value to me of a given, how do I want to put it? I guess the simplest way of is imagine that there is some dispute which benefits me by $10 and hurts you by $20. I'm not willing to, even if I've got the money, I'm not willing to spend an unlimited amount to get it. In fact, I'm only willing to spend $10 to get it. But you're willing to spend more than $10 to stop it. So you would expect the results of the of the litigation in either case to go towards the person who most values the outcome. So I guess that's a short answer, but we're out of time. Thank you.